Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. I have the absolute honour of having the very wonderful Joy Horner coming and joining me today to talk about the baby's perspective or experience of birth. Welcome, Joy. I'm very excited to chat to you today.
Oh, well, thank you, Erin. Thank you for inviting me. It's one of my favourite subjects.
Me too. So for those of you that you don't know Joy, Joy was a midwife for 21 years and she is now a sacred birth keeper, a perinatal consultant and wise woman. And I'm very excited to chat to you today. Do you want to just introduce yourself a little bit for anybody that hasn't heard of you or that everyone should have heard of you?
Yeah. I don't think everyone's heard of me, but yeah. Okay. So I did nursing before I did my midwifery. So I was a registered nurse and midwife for 37 years, although, as you said, I only practiced as a midwife for 21 years. And then 3 years ago, I thought, actually, no, I've had enough of this. I became a birth keeper. So I've had a really varied and really long career. And my midwifery, although it was only 21 years, it spanned over a 40-year period. Nearly 40 years, 38 years or so, because I did my training and then I left because I didn't like the medical model. And I thought I was a bad midwife because I didn't want to do those things to women. So I left for about, I think it was 12 years. And then I was teaching antenatal classes. I became an NCT teacher. And people kept saying, oh, I wish you were still a midwife, Joy. I wish you could be my midwife. And I was, no, never going back to that. I've got a cushy job as a nurse. I work in a factory. People come in for their medicals and we have a good chat. It was lovely, lovely work. And midwifery would have paid me less. Anyway, out of a moment of madness, I think I phoned up the university and said, if I were to do a return to practice course, what would it involve? And they said, well, you'd have to work for 3 months and write a couple of essays. And I went, actually, no, I think I'll stick with my cushy factory job. And then they phoned me, honest to God, the day before the interviews and said, we're interviewing tomorrow. Do you want to come along? And I said, I don't think I do, actually. And they said, well, here's the questions we're going to ask at the interview. And I thought, well, this is the universe pushing me in that direction, isn't it? You know, when do you get invited to an interview and you're told ahead of time what they're going to ask you? So I went along thinking, yeah, I still don't want to be a midwife again. And they offered me the return to practice. So I did that in 2002 until 2005. Trying to think back, get my numbers right. No, I did it in 2002 and then I worked in the birth centre till 2005. And then I became an independent midwife for 16 years, which was where the real education began.
So you have loads of knowledge. You're hugely knowledgeable on this topic. And this is why I was so excited to talk to you, because we've been chatting, haven't we? Kind of, we've got behind the scenes having little chats and things. And I think a lot of people, when they think about birth, they think very much about what's happening to the mother, the person that's pregnant. But it's actually a kind of dance between two people, because it's the mother and the baby. And you suggested that we chat about the baby's experience of birth, which I think is a really intriguing perspective to have a think about, because I think it's not probably something that people actually really talk about when we think about pregnancy and birth, is it?
Yeah, and it's such an awful shame because it's so important, because of course we've all been born, we've all gone through that intense experience, haven't we? And most of us might have forgotten our birth experience, but it is still there in our neurology, in our brain makeup and in our responses. And you can actually track down how you act as an adult to what happened to you during the birth and before.
Wow,
Yeah,
that's crazy, isn't it?
yeah, and I'm
And
not making
terrifying.
it is terrifying.
But I mean, genuinely, it is terrifying, isn't it? Because if you think about the kind of experience that the babies are having being born in modern day currently, I think that is terrifying, because a lot of children are not being born in a very positive manner. And who knows what impact that's having long term on their futures.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the more I did attend births and the more I was a midwife, the less and less I did, because I was more and more aware of how my very presence might impact negatively. I think Debs Niger wrote a fantastic thing recently about, her very presence being an intervention. And that's exactly how I viewed myself. Anything I do to the mother, even if I'm not touching the baby, even if I wasn't doing an internal, everything that happens to that mother or birthing person is felt by the baby, because they're one system, aren't they? So it's all important. It's so important. And I'm not a huge expert in it. It's one of my areas of fascination, because of my own birth process. And I was really lucky about 3 years ago now. I did a 2-year course investigating my own birth process with a man called Matthew Appleton. He's based in Bristol. He does fantastic trainings. And this one was specifically to go back and look at what might have happened. And as I said, most of us don't have that information stored in our brains, do we? And my mother passed a long time ago, so I can't find out too much detail about my birth, except it was quick and easy from my mum's perspective. Quick and easy, second baby. No hospital births in our family in the 60s. You didn't go to hospital unless you were ill. So yeah, quick and easy birth. And yet when I did this somatic re-experiencing, which is basically feeling sensations in your body, the information came flooding in. And I really actually, it's going to sound really naff, I really felt like I'd been born again with all this information about how I view the world and my fundamental beliefs about things. Because if you imagine a baby and its brain is developing, isn't it, in utero? And we know the longer a pregnancy can continue, the more the brain matures. Another very good reason not to induce unnecessarily. But in the first 1,000 days, which is conception until about age 2, 3 or so, the brain is making, it's wiring and firing, it's making all these really important connections. So if it makes a connection with pain, let's say a fetal scalp electrodes put on baby's head, it wires and fires those neurons together. Wow, that was pain. I mean, it doesn't have the words, but the bodily experience of pain is registered. If more pain happens, I don't know, forceps, vitamin K injection after birth, people handling baby roughly, they will keep firing those neurons, and that pathway will become really reinforced and really strong. And that's it, that highway is then set up in that baby's brain. And I'm not saying that we can't help babies deal with difficult births, because babies can recover and, they're not scarred for life. But we have to be aware that they are registering every single thing that happens to them. And unless we treat them sensitively after that period, if they've had a really difficult time, yeah, they can get stuck in that cycling of distress. And how it manifests gets is people that come to my baby group with crying babies. Now, we all know babies cry. It's how they communicate, isn't it? You know, whether they're tired or hungry or whatever. But there's a particular type of cry called a memory cry. And there's another cry called a dissonance cry, where the baby is just cycling in distress. And although its needs have been met, baby cannot get out of this system of like a body memory of fright or pain or frustration or fear or whatever it felt. You know, it's having a real body remembrance of something that happened to it. And this is where the integrative baby therapy can come in. So I did another 2-year course with Matthew Appleton in integrative baby therapy. And so it's treating the baby as a human being who has thoughts and feelings and memories. And although those memories aren't stored as words in the baby's head or pictures, you know, it wouldn't know what a fetal scalp electrode was. It wouldn't know where to store that memory in its brain, but it stores it in its cellular memory, like every part of the body. And it can get activated just because it needs to come up after birth. So all the baby's needs are met. You know, it's been fed and it's warm and it's not tired. And then a memory will come up for the baby. It'll get the feeling in its body of overwhelm or panic or whatever it is, and it will express that emotion.
I find this really fascinating. From my own personal perspective, I find this really fascinating, because I was a C-section, so I was breech, and so mum had a C-section, and my mum's father passed away 2 weeks before I was born,
Right.
so she was very, very upset, very understandably really struggling. My mum said I cried non-stop. I mean, all my baby photos, I have swollen eyes because I just cried all the time, and she just used to just she c couldn't console me and just used to leave me in the cot to cry. And now, looking thinking back on that now, with you know, knowing more of what I know now and knowing the effects of stress hormones on the unborn baby, because I've read studies around this as well. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? That even though the baby's not born, the baby is being influenced by everything that's happening to the mother. And that's probably had a huge impact on my adult life. I know it has, because my experience of birth, my experience of being in utero, and my, you know, my first life, first out, first hours, year, month of birth, after birth, has probably affected everything that came after it.
I know, it's the blueprint, isn't it? You know, people talk about blueprints and imprints and things, but it's the blueprint. Our brain is still so plastic, it is still forming in that first 1,000 days. And so what happens to baby is really, really important. And going back to my story, it actually sort of echoes your story a bit. So my birth that was quick and easy for my mum, when I explored it myself, it wasn't easy for me as a baby. And although it was a straightforward vaginal birth, second baby, I found it hard and I found it scary. And there were points where I thought, why am I doing this? Why am I incarnating? And I wanted to give up and I wanted to die and go back to source. That would have been a lot easier. And my mum's mum died when she was pregnant with me. So I was a 3-month fetus, you know, like everything was just developing. And my mum's mum died, and they had a very complicated relationship. So, you know, being bathed in grief and growing in a womb full of grief emotions has to have some sort of impact, doesn't it? And I'm not saying it's bad. It's not a bad thing. You were talking about cortisol, you know, mum's stress hormones going through to the baby. And I know this really worries lots of families. I had someone just last week say to me, I'm so anxious, but I'm really worried that this will affect my baby. Well, we have to be honest and say every emotion gets through to baby. And it's not as if we're in a war zone at the moment. You know, if we were giving birth with that threat of death on a daily basis, you know, and we were filled with cortisone every day, yeah, our baby's systems are going to be wired to come out and be prepared to live in a war zone. You know, it's a really useful adaptation, isn't it? And we know this from the babies that were babies of Holocaust survivors, you know, and how the effects of that have been shown for three generations at least. Because it makes sense on an evolutionary basis, doesn't it? If you're giving birth in a war zone, your baby knows that it has to be on the lookout. Of course it affects them. But the level of stress people who aren't in a war zone or under, you know, threat of domestic violence or, you know, in other horrible situations, average people who have a safe place to live and are just stressed most of the time, your baby can deal with that. Your baby is preparing for the outside world, which isn't all roses. It's getting a homeopathic dose of life is a bit stressful out here. You know, be prepared, as well as all the really good hormones, the oxytocin. And all we've got to remember is to balance it out. You know, if we've had a real awful day, you know, let's say we've been fired, you know, that's our livelihood gone. We can't think that things are going to get any worse. And we haven't had a moment to think about our babies. If we can sit down for a little bit in the day, tune into the baby and say, hey, it's really awful out here. I just lost my job, but this is my stuff. This isn't your stuff. You know, and tell the baby, you know, I love you. This isn't about you. It's about, you know, I lost my job and how awful it is. And yeah, really try and balance it out and let baby know what's going on.
I love that term that you've just said, that it's a like a homeopathic dose. I think that's a really nice analogy, I think. I think it puts it into perspective, I think, if somebody is worried that they're going through a tough time and how that's going to affect their baby. And then what about the all of the things that can happen during a birth, like how does that affect a baby? Because,
Oh my
you know, we
goodness.
have very medicalized births in the UK. That's the majority of births, I would say, are medical. And I think some people don't even realize they've had a very medicalized birth, because they might think that they didn't have any drugs, for example, so therefore they had an unmedicalized birth, but they're still potentially having monitoring, potentially having vaginal exams and sweeps and so on. So how are these procedures and interventions potentially affecting the unborn baby?
Yeah, so if we again go back to the premise that babies are sentient human beings having a real experience in the moment, and of course they can feel, and it wasn't that long ago, Erin, where we didn't think babies could feel pain.
Yes,
I know
I this
certain,
is horrific. This
yeah,
I
I know
when I learned this,
certain.
it horrified me.
Yeah, in my nursing training, you know, they were doing circumcision of little boys. I mean, I still think that happens in many areas without any anaesthetic. And I remember being told off when I was working in a neonatal unit, and we have to get blood out of the babies fairly quite frequently to check they're okay. You know, it's for a purpose, but it's a horrible thing to do to a baby. And I remember seeing one doctor do it, and he did it so aggressively. He did it unnecessarily roughly, you know, and really made the baby bleed a lot. And I remember going to the sister and saying, look, this isn't on. He can't be doing that to babies, and the baby's going to feel it. And she basically told me, you know, my opinion wasn't worth airing because he was a doctor, and I was just a student midwife. And yeah, but babies feel, of course babies feel. You know, they feel everything. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Right, so we jumped to the extreme there, didn't we? Looking at
But again, it's
specialty.
interesting, isn't it? Because I vividly remember with my eldest, they were doing the heel prick to get the blood sample, and the midwife lancing my daughter's heel over and over and over again because she couldn't get enough blood, and me saying, "Can you stop?" Because understandably, my daughter was wailing because this midwife kept on cutting her foot, and she was like, "Oh, she can't feel it. It's fine." And I remember thinking, "But she's absolutely beside herself crying. She obviously can feel it." But I think it was a really common assumption that babies didn't feel anything. I mean, one of the articles that I read mentioned that babies were not given any anaesthetic for surgeries. They were sedated so they couldn't move, but they weren't given any anaesthetic. And that's horrifying to
It's
think that
awful.
babies are operated on without any anaesthetic.
Awful. I mean, luckily that was before my time as a nurse, but certainly I've seen people act as if they think baby doesn't have any pain receptors whatsoever. And I think as a professional, some people have to do that for their own mental well-being. They can't go into work thinking I'm hurting babies on a daily basis, especially if they're a doctor or a surgeon. They have to be able to cut them open and operate on them. But yeah, let's not pretend that babies don't feel, because they definitely feel. But yeah, and baby, as I said, even if it goes through a really simple birth process, like myself, second baby, nice and easy, there's a lot happening for the baby, isn't there? Just if you imagine your head going into a really confined space, and then you've got to navigate your way through that really narrow space, and the pressure that must happen when contractions happen. I know, if baby's lucky, it's still surrounded by fluid and things, but the pressure when a contraction happens on baby's neck, and what if that cord is around the body or around the neck, and every time they go down, it's all. They're having all these experiences before we even do anything to them. So then we go along meddling. If I was a midwife, and I'd be doing an internal and feeling baby's head, and you can feel them moving. They're very aware of what we're doing. And sometimes midwives do it to see if they can, and doctors, to see if they can activate a baby. So if we're worried about a baby's well-being, perhaps the CTG trace had been really flat, and we're thinking, is that baby okay? If we do an internal and mess around with that baby's head, it will soon get activated if it's a well baby. But it's not a nice thing to do, is it? Fetal scalp electrodes, we've talked about. The ARM, if we're rupturing the membranes artificially, we've got a little hook. It's like a crochet hook, but it does have a little barb on the end of it. And we're scratching and scratching at that baby's head. Sometimes we're lucky, there's a big bulgy bag of water and we don't touch the baby's head. But sometimes, yeah, they come out with nasty little scratches. Fetal blood sampling, it is a little blade to get a few drops of blood to test. And again, if we look at it in perspective, if it's a choice between let's monitor this baby and see how well it's doing, or you're going to have a cesarean, the fetal blood sampling can really help women make that choice. But all of these things have to be done with an awareness that this is a human being that we're doing this to. And it's really good if people can speak to the baby beforehand. So whatever we're going to do, I normally say to the mum or birthing person, can you tell your baby what's going to happen? I've just told you what's going to happen. Tell your baby that they're going to feel whatever it is that we're doing. So baby has a bit of preparation. So let's look at things like forceps and ventouses. So you've been in the birth canal for a long time. You might be running out of energy. You might be like me thinking, why the heck am I doing this? I want to go back. And suddenly you feel something cold and hard on your head and a lot of traction pulling you out. Like it's a sudden thing without warning, isn't it? And you don't know what that is. A baby wouldn't have a clue what that is. So if parents or the doula or partner can say, hey, baby, someone's going to try and help you out here. We can see that you're struggling, and yeah, we all just want to help you out. And the same with a breech baby, born vaginally or born by cesarean, tell the baby what's going to happen. We don't want to shock them. Being born is an intense experience. We don't want to add to that.
I know there's so many things that can happen to the baby, and like you said, if it's even if it is a straightforward vaginal birth, if you imagine all of that movement that's happening to that baby's skull in order for all of those plates in the skull to overlap and change the shape of the baby's head, that must be uncomfortable, right? And there must be a significant amount of pressure on the baby's head in order to move and shift all of those plates in the skull, and that's with just a very straightforward birth. Once we start introducing those medical interventions, and this is what one of my massive bugbears is with fetal scalp electrodes. I all of my clients get told what a fetal scalp electrodes is when we're talking about different types of monitoring. Excuse me, because it's misrepresented. It's just a little sticker or just a little clip. No, it's actually a bulb that's breaking the baby's skin. And one of the risks of that is your baby will feel it. Your baby will feel it. And so I think midwives making sure that they're being honest and preparing the person giving birth for the procedures and things that they might be recommending or that they are suggesting to happen, and then the mother being able to warn the baby beforehand, because obviously the mother needs to know what's going to happen in order to prepare the baby, right? And let the baby know. There's a lot of I think there's a lot of missing information, I think, when it comes to birth, or kind of misrepresentation of different potential procedures that are happening, which I think leads to a traumatic experience all round for both the mother and the baby.
And it's not as if the trauma stops at birth, is it? I've seen some awful videos recently about when babies make that really gentle transition after birth, and it can be because they've been born in water, or it can be because they're a little bit compromised, birth's been a bit hard, they've been a bit oxygen deprived. And they just need a few minutes to come in and for their circulation to sort itself out before they take that first breath. And I've seen some horrible videos. I mean, they are American ones, but I wouldn't be surprised if something similar happens somewhere in the UK, that people panic when that baby comes out. Now, what that says to me is that the people that are present, the so-called professionals, haven't had enough experience to know that some babies are okay if you just leave them be to make that transition after birth. And some babies need help, and how to recognize the difference. Because what I hate to see, I really, really hate it with a vengeance, is a baby being roughed up with a towel, really roughed up, or being lifted up by an arm.
Oh, I've seen some horrible C-section videos of babies being lifted up and dangled upside down, and
Oh my goodness.
obstetricians being really rough with newborns, and it's
Oh,
awful.
it's dreadful. There's a picture, it's indelibly printed in my mind. I think it was on Instagram. And there's a doctor holding a baby like this after birth. Why? Why are you holding it like that? It's not a trophy. It's not a bloody fish that you've caught. Oh my goodness. It's awful. And baby is going through so much in that time after birth, when it is still recovering, and it needs enough blood to come back from the placenta to perfuse the alveoli in the lungs, to push all the fluid out so that it can take that first breath. And it might take a couple of minutes, and we don't need to pounce on baby straight away. And it's a completely different thing if a baby comes out white and floppy and unresponsive. It's a totally different picture. If you've seen a baby come out in real poor condition, you know when you have to act straight away, and there's no talk to your baby, rub your baby. No, sorry, I need to help your baby straight away. We need to give some inflation breaths. But that's not these pictures that I'm seeing. These are a well-perfused babies that have a bit of muscle tone, and they've just not taken their first breath yet.
I mean, they literally just need some time to recover from the birth process, don't they?
Absolutely. And for that blood to go back into them, let's say their heart rate's been a bit slow. Let's say it's a free birth. Nobody knows the heart rate's been a bit slow, but it's been a bit slow. So it'll take a little while, won't it, until that blood gets back into baby's system and it's got enough blood to perfuse the lungs. And it doesn't happen in an instant.
Yeah, it's one of my clients had a home birth, and her midwife was a little bit overzealous, I think, in wanting to cut the cord, because the baby came out looking a little bit blue, and she was like, oh, I don't like the look of the color of that baby, and she went to cut the cord, which A is, I think, is bonkers, because my client was like, well, do not cut the cord. If the baby's not breathing, I'll get out of the pool and you leave the baby attached to the placenta and you can resus the baby if baby needs it. But by the time they'd argued with the midwife to say, don't cut the cord, I'll get out, the baby pinked up. And she just didn't wait. She didn't wait. And I think I feel like that's becoming my mantra with issues in midwifery, is people don't wait. Everything is done without waiting. There's no, everything is rushed through. Everything is urgent. There is no watch and wait and see. It's no, we need to do it now. It's like the whole issue with the third stage of labor and birthing the placenta. I mean, I'd say a large portion of births, the placentas are forced out too quickly because midwives don't want to wait.
I'll agree with you wholeheartedly there. There is a big rush, it's for many, many reasons. I remember when I was an independent midwife, my client had gone for a cesarean. They wouldn't let me in the theatre, even though I'd worked at that hospital and they knew I was a registered midwife, but I wasn't allowed in. And I was chatting to the labour ward coordinator to pass the time. And she said, "It's so busy tonight." And I said, "Oh, it must be an awful job that you have." And she said, "Yeah, it's all to do with numbers and throughput. Numbers and throughput, Joy. I've got to get them all cleared off the labour ward because we've got more coming in. I've got to find out how many spaces there are on the postnatal ward. Numbers and throughput." I was just so shocked to hear someone admit it, like it's a sausage factory. And then the second reason is that people act out of panic. People act because that's what they always do at a birth. Because if we're dealing with medicalized birth, and that's what we're seeing every single day, we are seeing babies that are compromised and need quite a bit of stimulation. So that's what we do to every baby, because we're assuming every baby's going to need help. Whereas what we see in undisturbed birth is don't need to put our hands on the baby, don't need to put our hands on the woman. So I think it's like a knee-jerk trauma response, actually, from care providers. Sadly.
And the untold harm that is causing to the babies and people's experiences of birth. And then that has a knock-on effect on the postnatal period for both the baby and the mother. When I talk about instrumental birth, for example, with my clients, and we talk about why it might be done and why they might choose one, ventouse over forceps, and so on. And we talk about the risks to the mother of a instrumental birth, but also the risks to the baby, because even if baby comes out and baby doesn't have any lacerations, baby looks fine, I always tell all of my clients, if you have an instrumental birth, you need to go and take your baby to see a cranial osteopath. Because that inevitably is going to cause some kind of trauma to the baby's head and neck,
And, it's very common, I think, to see babies who are born by forceps, for example, be very unsettled afterwards. They have struck they have trouble with breastfeeding, because we've affected, that jaw and all the muscles in the head, and they're probably uncomfortable, or they may only want to feed on one side, because it's caused trauma to the muscles and the head and neck and shoulders. So the impact of the birth is then affecting the baby postnatally, and maybe possibly then we struggle to breastfeed, we go to formula, that has an impact on the baby. So there's all these kind of, it's almost like a micro domino effect, isn't it? Which kind of snowballs and gets bigger and bigger. We do one thing and then it impacts something else and it impacts something else. And where does that end? I think it's quite scary, to be honest.
If it's not picked up, if it's not treated, if they don't address what's going on for the baby, and I'd go a step further than you and say all babies need to go and see a craniosacral therapist
That's
or
true.
maybe osteopath because of the pressures of birth. And we know that the nerves to the gut come out of the base of the skull, don't they? Where it meets the spine. You imagine that the compression, that baby's under as it comes down. Working with the physicality of what might have happened. And I don't always think Ventouse is a better option. It's just another option, because the pulling on the baby's head can irritate various other structures in the head. The meninges, the lining of the skull, the covering of the brain. We can interrupt a lot with Ventouse, in a different way to forceps. And forceps can be protective in some circumstances, even though we do get the facial lacerations and bruising. And so I wouldn't say one's better than the other. So they both need to be addressed, as well as, baby's emotional well-being. How did this feel emotionally? And as I said, some babies are really struggling. Some babies are short of oxygen. That forceps is going to save their life or make the difference between them being having some sort of brain damage or not. Those babies, maybe if they're told that this is going to happen and it's going to help, maybe they'll think, thank goodness, I felt like I was going to die and someone came and helped me. Someone saved me. Perhaps that would be a really good thing for some babies. And yet other babies, even if they were really struggling and someone gently told them this was going to happen, they still might be affected by that in a different way. It still might not have been the right time for them or in the right way, or the sensations might have been too intense. So babies can have different experiences to what we'd think. I do remember seeing a forceps baby, and it was a nasty forceps, and baby was really quite battered and bruised afterwards. And I was wrongly assuming that that baby would have a big story to tell and, be really unsettled and awful. And he wasn't. He was okay. And conversely, I've seen quick, easy births, and the baby's really not okay. It has its own experience of what went on, and
Because
it
we're all
doesn't,
unique individuals, aren't we?
and it doesn't always match the mother's experience. Beautiful, lovely home water birth, and then a very, very distressed baby afterwards. Never a doubt with baby's heart rate or anything, no interventions, no VEs, no one touched baby after birth, physiological third stage. Extremely delayed cord clamping. But that baby had its own experience of birth, and there was something that it was very upset about.
So what would you suggest to support a baby after they've been born if they have, if they are struggling regardless of what happened, and if they've found that experience difficult, how do we support a newborn?
So how would we recognize that they might be struggling? Well, we don't have to be rocket scientists. Every mum and every birth worker that's seen quite a few babies will know if that baby is crying for a reason that we can do something about, or if it looks really stuck and whatever we do doesn't work. You know, it doesn't take a lot. There are various other things that babies do. If it's a memory cry, sometimes, and this is a whistle stop tour, so we won't get all the information in. Sometimes they can be looking up, you know, whilst they're crying. You know, they're not able to make eye contact. They're somewhere else. They're remembering something that's happening. They can show various behaviors. Let's indicate with baby here. So if you notice with any of your clients, or if your clients point out, baby's doing this really funny thing, this repetitive thing.
Or stroking their side of their face.
Or, you know,
Or the back of the head.
wherever, let's say there was a fetal scalp electrode and baby was really pulling at its hair. I saw one baby, it was literally pulling its hair out. You know, it's showing, I felt something here. Again, you see this in adults as well. Okay. You know, with the, when you come across something really frustrating and you're against that.
Cover your forehead with your hand.
Yeah, that brick wall. You know, perhaps you felt stuck at one point and you couldn't move forward. There are all sorts of body languages, facial expressions, even mouth movements that babies do that give us an indication about what their story is. So let's assume we don't, baby isn't doing any of that, but it's really distressed and we can't figure out why. And my first go-to is craniosacral therapist. So once they've had their appointment, baby's still crying. What can we do? The things that mums and birthing people do naturally. So you want to spend time skin to skin. You want to breastfeed if possible. And if not, you know, responsive bottle feed your baby, you know, being engaged, listening, communicating to your baby, but also listening to what they say. And I think this sounds a bit unbelievable to some people, but if we listen to them the same way as we do an adult, their behavior can change. If you came to see me, Erin, and you were really, really upset, and you came running into my house and you were crying your eyes out, and I sat you down and I put a sandwich in your mouth, I wouldn't get to find out what the problem was, and you certainly wouldn't feel heard. So it's great that we can soothe babies with our breasts and we can soothe them by rocking. I had a client who rocked their baby for months and months and months, and baby wouldn't cry while it was being rocked. But they had to do that a lot of the day. And when they stopped, baby would cry. So if we listen to baby, and it's the same way that you would do active listening, which you probably know about, but not everyone knows about. So if we're having a conversation, you come in crying, I then switch over to, this isn't about me, this is Erin, she needs to talk about something. I'm going to stay quiet and let her say her piece until she pauses for breath. And then I'm going to count to 10 to see if she's got any more to say. And then I might add something. No, then I might actually say, and then what happened? With a baby, it's exactly the same. So the baby is crying its eyes out. Poor little thing. We can be face to face. Really doesn't matter because baby might have its eyes shut if it's really, really upset. But if you can hold baby face to face, I'm here for you. I hear that you're upset. You know, I'm really sad you're upset. I'd really like to help you. You know, whatever words come into your mind, I want to help this baby. And of course, babies don't understand the words because they haven't learned the words yet, but they understand the intent, really understand the intent. Then we have to work on our own self-regulation because babies can't regulate their emotions and they're entirely led by what they feel around them. So, mum, dad, you know, whoever else might be in the partnership needs to breathe, needs to relax, needs to try and calm themselves And that in itself is going to have some effect on baby. And then we continue listening to the baby cry because baby is telling its story. And we reflect back what we see in the same way as if you were sat at my kitchen table. Goodness, Erin, you look really upset. You know, do you want to tell me about it? And then you're telling me about it and you're sobbing. Goodness, you look exhausted. You know, exactly the same with the baby. Oh, you look really frustrated, feeding back what you see. And do you know what that does? Baby actually knows it's being witnessed and heard and understood. And that's all human beings need, isn't it? To get over, you know, the majority of traumas. To have your needs met, to be seen, to be heard, to be understood.
Wow.
Quite simple, really.
Yeah. Yeah, but probably doesn't happen though, does
It
it?
doesn't happen.
No.
It doesn't.
No.
As you said earlier, and I know in the 60s, you know, it was if a baby cries, you put it in the pram
Put it
and push
down,
it
yeah.
into the garden. And then if baby's still crying after an hour, you push it further down the garden so you can't
Oh,
hear it. That
God.
was what my mum told me.
Yeah.
So what does
Yeah.
this tell our babies?
Yeah.
You know, your needs aren't going to be met. You're only going to be fed every 4 hours by the clock. You know, you have to learn to override your natural instincts like hunger. No one's going to be there for you if you're upset, and your crying is unacceptable. Now, what does that do for an adult?
Yeah, it's worrying, I have to say.
Worrying.
But it's and again, it's interesting. You know, I've got three children, and my parenting journey has evolved over three children.
Yeah.
With my first having a very medicalized birth, and us being really strict on trying to get her to sleep in her cot and, you know, sleep in her own bed. And I remember like ninja crawling across the floor to try and get away from her, because, and she would wake up and then she would like, I'd literally have to sit on the floor with her gripped onto my finger through the bars of the cot because she wouldn't let go. Fast forward to now, both my 8-year-old and my 4-year-old still sleep in my bed. And I mean, Daisy, my 8-year-old, never even slept in a cot, and actually neither did Ty. She had a cot, but she didn't sleep in it, and I didn't even bother putting the cot up for Ty because there was no point. He just slept in my bed, and he always has. And you look at my three children and their personalities, and you know, the way they deal with things is very different. It's very different. And that's very hard to accept as a parent, that, you know, I can see the choices that I made when they were very small and the impact that has had on them as they have developed into, you know, toddlers and preteens. It's so important. It's so important. The choices you make right from conception and preconception, you know, and all the way until they are adults, have an impact. And I always come back to this. That's why it's prep and educating yourself is so important. You know, it's one of the reasons why I do the podcast, to, you know, it's a free resource of really important information, because so many of us don't, I didn't have access to this, and maybe I would have made very different choices if I had. So
I'm wholeheartedly with you. I think we give ourselves a bad rap as mothers, though, and we're willing to take the blame for everything, because I know I was the same with my first. I found it incredibly hard. I'd had a very difficult labour, traumatic labour. Both my baby and I were traumatised. But I do believe our babies choose us because of the parents that we are and the lessons that they have to learn in this lifetime to be the perfectly beautiful people that they are. So, and I do wrestle with myself, you know, the chicken and the egg. Did my firstborn choose to be a brow presentation and have that difficult entrance? And therefore, is that why they are as they are? You know, we had our difficult journey together. Or did the birth affect my baby, or was my baby like that beforehand and chose that, if you know what I mean? You know, because my oldest is autistic, they're transgender, they're the most beautiful, magical human being that I knew from the word that they came out, but they are so different to my second born, who was a straightforward VBAC. But yeah, is it nature or nurture? There's a brilliant book. It's called Being Born. You can't get it. It's out of print. But if you ever come across it, Being Born by Robin Furness. And it's R-O-B-Y-N, Robin. I think she's Australian, but I may be wrong. All about the different types of births, fast birth, slow birth, early birth, late birth, induced birth, cesarean, all of the births, and how it might affect our children and how we can work with that after birth. It is absolutely fabulous. She does have a website. People tell me you can download PDFs for the type of birth that you
Oh,
want to look
wow.
at.
I have
Yeah.
to go and have a look.
Go and
That
have a
sounds
look at it.
fascinating.
I cried my eyes out when I read about the cesarean after having my cesarean. So I don't advise pregnant women to read it. You know, if they're preparing for a birth after trauma, I don't want them to beat themselves up anymore. You know, because I do believe our babies choose us and choose the experiences that they want to have in this lifetime. However horrible that sounds, you know, sounds awful, doesn't it? You know, that anyone would choose a difficult entry into the world, but it's what makes us as human beings. I had a lot of adverse things happen in my childhood, and I've come to a point where I don't blame anyone, and I can see that it's made me who I am, and I wouldn't be quite as me if I didn't have all those things happen to me. I might be quite bland and uninteresting.
Oh, I can't imagine that, Joy.
Can you imagine if you'd had a boring life where everything had been fine, you'd have perfect parents, perfect birth, but what would your life be? Yeah, no, quite happy that I chose this life and my entrance into it and my parents.
So where can people find you? If, because I feel like people need to follow you and they need to consume more of your amazing information and just your general vibe and aura I love so much. So where can people find you aside from this episode?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I have a website called Birth Joy. You can find a lot of information on there, although I actually host the site and I'm not really good on the internet and website, so it doesn't look very impressive, but you can find how to contact me. Yeah, if you look up Birth Joy, Joy Horner. I'm on Instagram. I'm the Wise Woman Collective, or Wise Woman on the Hill. And I don't define myself as being a wise woman. My lovely eldest child called me Wise Woman on the Hill, and sort of tongue in cheek. And it, yeah, I liked it. Yeah, I'm on Facebook. I'm on all the usual places you'll find me about. And I'm doing more and more work in the field of pre and perinatal psychology. You know, it is my passion. Now I've stopped being a midwife. I also run courses for doulas and midwives. And I've just finished working for the Sacred Birth Centre team in Glastonbury, but that's going to be a really exciting project. So you'll be able to find me at the Sacred Birth Centre. I run a clinic there once a week. So anyone from, you know, all over the country can come down to Glastonbury, see me in my clinic on a Tuesday afternoon. Yeah, get an appointment with me.
Oh, thank you so much for today, Joy. I've loved it. It's been fascinating, utterly, utterly fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. I feel that we've just scratched the surface,
I
but I'm
know.
yeah, there's so much that I still need to know about it. Thank
Thank you,
you.
Joy.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.